This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, welcome to the program. When politicians and economists celebrate economic growth, how many of you really feel the joy? Or are you still overworked, underpaid, even a little lonely? A former Archbishop of Canterbury says we need a new way to measure prosperity and well-being. I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. Rowan Williams has become a popular philosopher since retiring as Archbishop, and he joins us soon. And is there a balance between the rights of faith-based schools and the gay students and teachers who work in them? Now, the presumed murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul challenges the very idea of a new modernizing Saudi Arabia. Khashoggi was no Western-style liberal, but he'd become a persistent critic of the Saudis and their supposedly reformist crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. His regime still embodies and exports a harsh form of Islam known as Wahhabism or Salafism. Dr. Ibrahim El-Marashi is a professor at Cal State University in the US. He's experienced Saudi Arabia from the inside, so what does he think of the crown prince?
I would say rather than a reformer, he's seeking to consolidate power in the event that he will become king. And in this case, as a consolidator, two problems he has to deal with is Saudi Arabia's international reputation vis-a-vis the war in Yemen and dealing with the Saudi youth bulge. And reforms are a way of relieving pressure from the demands from younger people in society.
I mean, we've seen the most quote-unquote celebrated of reforms, that being to allow women to drive. But yet, Ibrahim, as you well know, because you know this region very well, on the books of Saudi law are still things like amputations and beheadings. I mean, how really reformist can the Crown Prince be if these sorts of things still stand in Saudi society?
Yes, in fact, I've witnessed both beheadings and hand amputations in Saudi Arabia. And those are, you know, areas that the Saudi government specifically ties to religion. And it doesn't seem like it can touch those what are considered kind of sacrosanct practices. And of course, for its international reputation, that's what they try to keep kind of hidden. Allowing women to drive is a way from detracting from those practices that I don't think will ever be ended in the kingdom.
And you have lived in Saudi Arabia as a scholar. You actually don't think we'll ever see, maybe not in our lifetimes at least, the end of these very harsh penal practices?
You know, when they're done is right after the Friday prayers. So here you have a government that's conflated on the most holy days, what is religious practice, and then afterwards, these kind of barbaric practices, which I think are meant to kind of appease the religious establishment, the religious lobby within Saudi Arabia. And that's the game the king and, of course, the presumptive crown prince has to play. Alleviate pressure from the young, but then, you know, satiate the conservative demands of the religious establishment.
You've identified that youth bulge in Saudi Arabia. Amongst that youth bulge, is there, if you like, a liberal tendency that's emerging that could force the government to change its policies, some of the harshest policies?
With that youth bulge, a good number of them have scholarships to study abroad. So that, you know, they spend time abroad, they come back hoping to find jobs. And of course, the Saudi economy can't keep up with the pace. So these are really kind of superficial, if you will, concessions to a kind of a group that would ideally like to see more kind of liberal attitudes as well as economic growth. And if you can't provide economic growth, then these kind of concessions in the public sphere are the only resort that the crown prince has.
Martin Chulov, The Guardian's Middle East correspondent, has said that on visits to Saudi Arabia in more recent times, he has in fact seen, for example, much more fraternizing between men and women who aren't related, that there is some liberalizing strand in Saudi Arabia. Is that what you've detected?
When I was living there in the 90s, that was unseen. So perhaps, again, this is one of the concessions you can make for the kind of growing youth population to just kind of relieve the pressure, you know, given to societal demands while not making any concessions in the political sphere.
Is there a liberal secularist strand to the Saudi population? Because it's unheard of in the West, but it might surprise us.
Well, if there is, they have really no venues for being overt in Saudi public life. I mean, if anything, Jamal Khashoggi represented that liberal strand, and that's it. His murder was a way to kind of silence his voice, but a voice of kind of maybe a segment within Saudi society that don't have a means to express themselves.
Ibrahim, you've also lived in Istanbul, so you know Turkish politics very well. Is the Turkish government trying to develop, what, an affinity with the Saudis that's now just been upset by the apparent murder of Khashoggi? Were they trying to get close to Saudi Arabia?
I mean, no, you had, feelers between Turkey and Saudi Arabia maybe in the mid-2000s. But since 2011, Saudi Arabia and Turkey have diverged. They've diverged in who they support in the Syrian civil war. Turkey took Qatar's side when Saudi Arabia blockaded it. So already you had a chasm developing. But I think since 2011, both Turkey and Saudi Arabia sought to project themselves as a kind of a regional hegemon amongst the region's Sunnis. So already you have that kind of regional split, if you will. But just simply put, from the Turkish perspective, even though the murder was done in the consulate, it's still seen as a violation of Turkey's sovereignty, which they guard jealously.
Is Saudi Arabia really feared and or respected in the region? I know it's got lots of money, but I wonder whether in recent years, especially as oil has ceased to be such a prized commodity around the world, whether Saudi Arabia is losing some of its power.
In terms of sheer military power, it will never be able to project its power like Turkey or Iran does. In that case, the projection of military power is usually the basis of some kind of respect. In terms of a country that has a strong developing economy, it doesn't have that where others in the Middle East would seek to emulate it. So I would say Saudi Arabia is neither feared nor respected. Particularly its actions in the war in Yemen, it's not going to generate any sympathy in the region either.
Yes, well, you've written critically about what they're doing in Yemen, the Saudis, a civil war, I think something like 20,000 people killed already. Why is Saudi Arabia continuing to prosecute this war in Yemen with, I should add, the backing of Donald Trump's America?
I think it was a miscalculation. I think they thought the war would be, an air war would be quick and swift. Now that it's becoming more of a quagmire, Saudi Arabia would lose face if they stop the air campaign. For Saudi Arabia, it's not necessarily a loss for them. As long as they continue the air war, it doesn't require a sacrifice of their military forces. And as long as the U.S. doesn't condemn it, the international community might well. But Saudi Arabia says, we can't lose face. We've invested so much. They've sunk cost into it. And I think that's why they keep on prosecuting a war that's essentially a quagmire.
That's Dr. Ibrahim Al-Marashi of Cal State University in the U.S. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. The leaders of Australia's major religions have publicly opposed any law that would allow faith-based schools to expel gay students. But since parts of the federal government review of religious freedom were leaked, there's been renewed debate about whether religious schools should discriminate against teachers who use their new legal right to same-sex marriage. Law professor Ian Benson of Notre Dame University has advised the Canadian and Irish governments on these issues, and he's been looking at the Australian situation.
Well, I think the law in that respect has been well established in the definition of religion in the Scientology case here in Australia by your High Court back in the 1990s, where they talk about the importance of religions being able not just to be beliefs that are held, but beliefs that are practiced. And that means that religious associations have the ability and the right recognized in the common law and in law generally, in international human rights, particularly Article 18 of the ICCPR, to hold their religious beliefs.
Which is the international
International Convention on
Covenant
Civil and
on
Political
Civil
Rights.
And political rights, right, correct, which Australia signed and now needs to domesticate with respect to religion. They haven't done it with religion. They've done it with other categories, disability and race and so on. But in various ways, Australia needs to become more protective about religious liberties, particularly with respect to associations. And you mentioned schooling. Schooling is one example of that.
Yeah, well, let's see if we can sort out this issue, Ian. What should happen in the case where a school wants to teach a particular doctrine that may be at odds with the prevailing secular worldview? How should that be accommodated without discriminating against the student or the teacher?
Well, we have to be careful here about how we use the word discriminate, because to make distinctions in law is not the same as what might be called an unjust discrimination. We have to make discriminations all the time in society, and they're valid. For example, age with respect to driving, disability with respect to blind people not being able to fly planes, et cetera, et cetera. And yet age and disability, like religion, is protected within international documents. So the question then is, what is just discrimination? Not whether there can be discrimination. There has to be discrimination of certain sorts. So what constitutes just discrimination when it's matters about belief is that a society that's an open society and committed to diversity and appropriate forms of pluralism has to allow different groups to have their belief systems. And this means that religions, which believe that marriage should be male and female, should be entitled not just to hold that belief, but to teach it, to manifest it within their associations.
Can't we just decide that as long as the doctrine and the ethos of the faith-based school is taught, then the sexuality, the identification of the teacher and the student is immaterial, as long as the doctrine and ethos is taught?
I don't think we could say the same questions apply to teachers as to students. The leaked report, and I've not read the report, so I'm not going to comment on it, because one needs to see recommendations in context. So it's a bit of a folly to try and argue back from the recommendations. I would say there's a distinction there. And as far as I understand the popular debate at the moment, there's no attempt being made here to exclude students on the basis of their sexual orientation. But there's certainly a right of associations to hire those who carry out, not just in belief, but in practice, the beliefs of the community. And that approach has been upheld in the high courts of other countries, such as Canada, for example.
I noticed, though, for example, Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Brisbane, you wouldn't describe Mark as a liberal Catholic, but he said that the Catholic Church did not seek to discriminate against teachers or students based on their sexuality, gender, or relationship status, and that they'd welcome staff and students from all backgrounds who are willing to accept the declared mission and the values of the school community. Isn't that the best compromise?
Well, one of the things, Andrew, here is that you don't really understand religions from the outside, and you can't. And part of the reason we allow diversity of belief and practice, by the way, is because we recognize that we don't all agree about things. So when you ask me to endorse Bishop Coleridge's view as the best one, I'm not going to do that.
Look, let's just conclude, Ian, with an interesting case that has been resolved in the United Kingdom. And this was the case of a baker in Northern Ireland. He and his wife declined not to bake, but to decorate a cake that advocated same-sex marriage. Now the highest court in the UK has decided that the baker was and his wife were within their rights to decline to decorate the cake in a particular way. What are the implications for international and Australian law?
I think there's a couple of things governments could do here. The first would be to make amendments to Commonwealth legislation, such as the Fair Work Act, to ensure that employers and employees are protected in relation to religious and conscience belief, the two things together. The cake case in Ireland, a unanimous decision of the United Kingdom Supreme Court, followed in some key respects decisions in Canada involving a printer. And in those cases, they hold that people who provide services ought not to be compelled to support viewpoints they disagree with. What this means is we have to make fine, nuanced distinctions about when it's a refusal of services, which is not allowed, and when it's a refusal of a particular kind of service, which is allowed.
That's Law Professor Ian Benson. And you're with Andrew West. In its latest economic outlook, the International Monetary Fund forecasts a small boost to Australia's GDP. But is gross domestic product, that is, the total value of all goods and services produced in a country, really the best measure of a society's success? The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, now runs the global humanitarian group Christian Aid. I met him in Buenos Aires at the recent G20 Interfaith Summit, and he told me that it was time to totally rethink the way that governments and nations measure the well-being of their citizens.
Well, in a nutshell, I think it's the fact that we treat GDP as the only real measure of development. And as people are beginning to recognize, a rise in GDP doesn't automatically bring a rise in real employment. It doesn't bring a rise in a sense of security, well-being, or distribution of goods and opportunities. So there's something very wrong if we use that as the main measure. It means that we're developing a tiny sliver of our human experience.
Is it based on a particular ideology, do you think?
It's a good question. I don't think it's based on any one ideology. I think it's based, in a way, on lazy thinking. GDP is very easy to deal with in metric terms. We know how to calculate it. What's important to remember, I think, is that GDP has a story. There was a time when we didn't think like that, and then we started thinking like that. And you have to ask a bit why. Part of the answer is, as I say, it's easy. Part of the answer is it makes life a little bit more comfortable for those on the top of the heap, and that usually wins arguments.
Will you mention the top of the heap? If the current development model has not worked for the developing world, I wonder if now, 10 years on from the global financial crisis, has it actually worked for the Western liberal world as well?
This is the real irony, of course, that you have a system which is innately unstable, which goes on creating instability, where there's a huge kind of inbuilt structural incentive to take massive risks, which are not necessarily with your own resources, but with other people's. All of that came through in the crisis of 10 years ago. We've missed every single opportunity of doing anything about it. But clearly, GDP-based models of development are not functioning. Levels of recorded happiness, job satisfaction, rising inequality, all of this suggests that in the long run, everybody pays.
I mean, you see this now in your capacity as the head of Christian Aid, but I wonder when you were the Archbishop of Canterbury, did you see this happening in liberal modern Britain as well?
Very much so. I remember writing shortly after the financial crisis really got underway 10 years ago, a little piece in The Spectator, of all places, which is not a
magazine. Your natural milieu.
Not my natural milieu, and not one where I'm very popular, suggesting that in one respect, at least, Marx was right. We were in an economic situation where the real economy of actually producing things and trading took second place to a kind of fictional, virtual economy where what you traded was noughts on the end of figures over computers. So it seemed to me at that point we were already in a dangerously unreal, irrational situation. And then a little bit later, when austerity measures first came in, I began to hear a lot from clergy who were working in poorer areas around the country about the cost to vulnerable communities, the rising levels of hunger and instability, family insecurity, and the rest of it. It just seemed to me we were becoming a more anxious and more frightened society because of this. I was hearing this from the ground up, and it's one of the things which, you know, with all its failings and ambiguities, the Church of England can do because we've got somebody in every community. And people would pick up the anxieties, they'd pick up the fears, the needs, because vulnerable people still tend to turn to the church. But I was also hearing from economists who were saying, we've got an economic model that is hugely dysfunctional, which ignores all kinds of factors about long-term stability in favor of an increasingly narrow, increasingly feverish stress on financial services and their products.
Yes, but of course, you know the comeback. Well, look, even if we've got this vast army of unemployed or underemployed people, they can still afford very cheap goods. We're giving them lots of consumer choice. Isn't that the key thing?
Consumer choice is a very strange thing because, of course, its limits are dictated by production, who controls production. And the fact that, yes, as you say, poorer people in developed economies have more choices because even poorer people are making even cheaper goods, project that 10, 15 years, what you're not doing is creating an intelligent market. You're driving more and more people into marginal economies, into the kind of situation where there's no leverage they can have on the real economy. You're creating, as we've now got, an economy of short-term jobs, non-jobs, the gig economy, as people say. Mm. How stable is that? How productive is that in the long term?
You had a very stark message for the economic and political elites who gather at Davos in the Swiss mountains. You sent out that message earlier this year. What did you tell them? Because you were pretty blunt, actually.
I've never been entirely convinced that the Davos philosophy is going to work without some real injection of a basic question. Is the model workable? With contained in that, the question, is the model moral? I'm not one of those people who thinks that morality is the opposite of practicality. Morality exists because humans are the way they are. They need certain goods of relation and security provided by family and community. They need those goods as much as they need food and water. Create an economy which just ignores most of that for most people, and you actually create an unworkable economy.
It's the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West, and I'm speaking with Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. He's now the head of Christian Aid, and now he's very much an activist for the developing world. Rowan, you've also written, and this was also in your book, Faith in the Public Square, that the problem with the economic system isn't just the superficial critique of greed. I mean, it's very easy to look at the massive salaries that bankers have accrued to themselves, but you think there's a much deeper malaise. What's that?
I think the deeper issue is a kind of general cultural unwillingness to accept that we live with limits, that all of us are mortal, we're all going to die. All of us live in a world where we can't have everything, where, therefore, our good and our security depends on other people. You know, there's a spiritual question there that has to be addressed.
Not for me to tell the former Archbishop of Canterbury, but this is a heresy in modern liberal terms to say that we can't have everything and that we have to live with, if not scarcity, then we have to live with limits. Is that a heresy in modern political economy?
It certainly seems to be, because we still work on the assumption that indefinite financial growth is possible, despite the fact that we live in a materially limited world. Now, you'll be familiar with the statistics that say if every nation in the world consumed at the level of, say, Canada, the UK, or the United States, we would actually need the equivalent of six planets. There just is not enough for that level to be sustained indefinitely for everybody. Now, what's the matter with us that we can't see that there's a problem there? We need, therefore, to live in a way which respects the limits of the world we've got, where there is, as is often said, enough for us to survive. Why can't we understand that the world where we are all really secure is the world where we guarantee each other's security by our generosity, by our willingness to level out the inequalities? Now, Christian Aid, which I have the great privilege of chairing at the moment, had a slogan which has really got into the popular bloodstream, that we believe in life before death. What we meant by that and what we still mean by that is that we're committed to the possibility that everybody can and should have what they need to live well, that is to live with confidence, to live with inner security as well as outer security.
You have developed five principles for a more ethical global policy. I'll save some time by mentioning that one of them is the very obvious critical importance of the environment and bearing in mind the cost of the environment with our economic decisions. What are the other four?
I can't remember.
Well, I'll prompt you. The importance of restoring trust in public dealings.
Certainly in the last decade, probably more, we've had a kind of twofold crisis in trust in our public life. Very generally, I think we've inherited a kind of social approach which is a bit wary of pretty well any kind of public service and large-scale institution. We were wary, certainly in the UK, of nationalised industries for some understandable reasons. Not all of them were working well or efficiently. But somehow that leaked out into a general mistrust of professions, a mistrust of expertise, and that's come through in different ways in the last couple of years of people saying, well, we've had enough experts, don't tell us what to think. Then, more recently, I think we've had a more specific crisis in the trustworthiness or the perceived trustworthiness of politicians and people in public life. A series of scandals, a series of, you know, very highly colored tales about that, and the rise of certain people in the political world, naming no names, who don't exactly give off the aura of being entirely trustworthy persons, people who's...
Who talk about fake news, no names, no pack drill, but everyone gets it.
Yeah. So, if you've got that mistrust in institutions and public life, what you've got, I think, is a society that's always on the edge of being very cynical and therefore very unhopeful about things. And, you know, I'm bound to say, in all honesty, the church has lost that credibility as well, and it's lost it for good reasons. All the things that have come through in our church, as well as in other churches, about a record of abuse and collusion and inadequate response to safeguarding and protection. You know, I'm not surprised if people lose their trust, but somehow we've got to get back that sense that there are institutions worth investing in, worth trusting in.
I'll just remind you of the other principles, because I thought they were very powerful. The second was to create international standards for wages and working conditions. Another was to reform institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the G20. We're here at a conference on the G20 convened by Griffith University for the G20 Interfaith Summit. What's the biggest single reform that G20 nations could undertake to achieve your better global ethic?
People often talk about the need for democratizing institutions like this, and I think if you're talking about G20, or indeed any country involved in this sort of discussion, the challenge is how do you actually sound out your own population as to the kind of society they want to live in? You can have a governing elite, an economic group at the top of the heap, to use that expression again, who will debate these things without very much sense of what the aspirations of a population, especially a deprived population, might be. So I wonder whether we ought not to be asking governments to do more of that systematic long-term consultation. I was talking to somebody earlier today about a process that went on in my own country, which is Wales. A few years ago, I have to put in a plug for my homeland, where preparatory to a discussion in the Welsh Assembly, the process was to go around Wales to lots of communities with questionnaires of various kinds, saying, what kind of country do you want this to be? And one of the outcomes of that was that the Welsh Assembly passed legislation, the Future Generations Act, saying that any enactment of the Welsh government and of local government within Wales should be taken with full awareness of the future costs, the future implications, so that every important political and social policy was future tested. And of course, that immediately implies issues about sustainable forms of society, sustainable forms of prosperity, and ecological responsibility. Now, if Wales can do that, so can other places.
Lord Rowan Williams, thank you very much for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
My great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed, Andrew.
And you can hear a longer version of that discussion at the Religion and Ethics Report homepage at the RN website. And you can find us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your favourite podcasts. Thanks to Mutta Tadias and Bryce Halliday. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.